Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is writer and historian Jeremy Minot. He is an emeritus fellow of Wolfson College, Cambridge, and was formerly chief executive of Cambridge University Press. And we're talking about his new book, The Story of Nature, A Human History. Jeremy, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you, Mark. It's great to be on the air with you again.
This is a book, as soon as I began to even just think about when you let me know that you were writing this book, I just got the feeling this is the book you've been working on one way or another all your life.
Well, I think it's true in a way. I mean, the actual writing probably took 3 or 4 years.
I can imagine.
But before that, I was feeding in. It's a summation of where I think we've got to, and it's been important to me because, in a way, it's my chance to try and say what this all means to us. It means to us both in the sense of what we mean by the word nature and what it means to us in the sense of why it all matters. And, you know, I've been a naturalist all my life, as I'm sure you have, and so I've pondered these things not only in the study in the library, but also in the fresh air. You know, every time I go out there, I'm thinking about the experiences I'm having and what they amount to and why they matter to me.
That's
what this book's about.
It's such an essential book because it's one of those things, even if you are a person who's interested or works in the field of natural history, a lot of people don't even think or ponder about the most essential question. What are we doing? Why do we think this is really important? What is nature? And that's what your book begins with. It traces the idea and even the word nature.
Yeah, I have a little playful dialogue involving Socrates at the beginning where I imagine him quizzing some Athenian scientist who is supposed to be an expert on nature, asking him rather innocently what he actually means by it. And, of course, it gets rather difficult to say, is it just the natural world? Is it the wildlife? Does it include humans? Does it include domesticated animals as well as wild animals? You know, and the truth is that all these meanings have been part of the word over history. It's like a kind of river with great tributaries going into it and then some of them leaving it again. So asking the question, what is nature? My intention was to disorient the reader slightly, to make them stand back and think, hang on, I thought I knew about nature, but what is it?
It's fascinating. And the other thing is you talk about the trouble focusing yourself to write this book. There's a great quote that happened to you from Michael McCarthy, who said, can you tell me what the book is in about 10 words? You failed the first time, but you nailed it the second time.
Yes, I think I ended up with what is nature and why does it matter? That was a brilliant question from my friend Michael McCarthy. It's a question actually in a similar form that as a publisher, I used to ask authors who were struggling to express themselves. I think it's rather a good discipline.
Now, you also use a lot of artwork, both timely artwork, depending upon the chapter. But in the case of the introduction, you have a great example, Bruegel the Elder's painting of Hunters in the Snow. And you ask the reader, like, where is nature? Where isn't it? Is it all just nature? What's going on in that? And it's a really tough question to answer.
And it's a question you can ask yourself just looking out of the window, can't you?
Yeah.
You can see a garden, perhaps. Well, a garden is cultivated. Does that mean it's part of nature, or does that mean it's part of culture? You can see some wild animals, perhaps, and some domesticated animals. You can see some parts of the landscape that have been shaped by humankind. Are they all part of nature? It takes you right into that question.
It's amazing for me even to look at certain species of birds. Like if I look at house sparrows here, they're definitely part of the urban landscape, as are starlings. And they were not native here. They are. So are they nature? And if so, how are they different from the migratory warblers or seabirds that we see around here? Where does nature stop? Where does it end? And it is a really difficult question, but what you've done in this book, which just blows my mind, you actually have traced the evolution through time of human societies and their relationship and how they thought about nature. And that sort of made it really stand out for me about thinking about these questions. Not that I have an answer, but
no, well, I have a long answer, and it's about 90,000 words.
Yeah. I love the fact that, and well, you even asked the question, is climate change natural or humanity? And the thing is, it's a natural response to a human-caused problem.
Yeah. Well, it's a great question, which prizes open some of these other questions, because it's customary to say that all the other great extinctions of life on Earth have been from natural causes,
yeah,
like massive climate change, asteroid strikes and things like that. But to contrast that with the last one, which we call the beginning of the Anthropocene, which has been affected by human activity. Now, is that natural or not? Because the people who would argue that it isn't natural quite often are the same people who stress that human beings are a part of nature. And so there's a kind of paradox there, which, as you've pointed out, stresses the idea of what we mean by nature.
You begin by looking at cave art and the humans, yeah, that painted them. Now, I had a whole other career, and I still do, in art, and taught at museums here. And I'll tell you, cave art, Neolithic, Paleolithic art, has always freaked me out. It's like there's no other word for it.
Yeah.
I've been in Australia and seen, up at the top end, I've seen the native Australians' art. I've been in Spain and seen, prehistoric art there. And this art from these people really blows my mind. It's from 17,000 to 37,000 years old. And it's
right,
found all around the world. And it's not
right,
just art on caves. There are objects. There are figures. There's flutes. That means there was music. It almost seems like it sprung out like all at once around the globe.
Yeah. Well, I suppose it's the first kind of symbolic language that we had expressing ourselves through art before written language came along. And in the case of the European cave art, which is the one I take as my principal example,
yeah,
it's often to do with what they saw around them and the preoccupation they had with hunting and with defense, thinking of humans as both prey and as predators.
Do we know that the purpose of their art? I mean, do we have a clue? Since there's no written like language explanation, we just have these incredible examples. I think the thing that surprises me the most is how sophisticated they are.
Yeah. Yes, they seem to have come about fully formed, don't they?
Yeah.
It's quite extraordinary. But I do discuss in my book some of the theories that have been presented about what the purpose of it was. But in the end, I decide that rather than trying to solve the question of purpose, which we actually can't solve in the absence of any documentation, it's best to try and concentrate on what we can learn from it and what we can learn from it about their depiction and attitude and relationships with the wildlife that they illustrate so graphically in these pictures, and I think we can learn things from that. In the case of the European art, it's often basically a hunter's view of the world, isn't it?
But as you bring up in the book, Jeremy, they don't paint as often some of their most common foods like reindeer.
No, that's quite right. I do make that point. But it's also very striking, isn't it, that they don't picture what we would think of as landscapes or,
yeah,
butterflies,
yep,
or flowers. It's very much a focus on these animals and on what we think of as the megafauna in the case of the European art. And it may be that they, like we, are rather overimpressed by the megafauna, that there's a kind of charisma about them which attracted,
yeah,
them.
It's the human population at this time, too, and you write about this in the book, is actually rather small.
It is small, and I mean that emphasizes the point that we were just one animal amongst these others.
Yeah.
We hadn't separated ourselves from it. We weren't even quite often the most dominant animal, but we finally emerged from being one animal amongst others to being a particular kind of animal that was self-conscious and could reflect on the fact that there were different kinds of animals around. And that's the beginning of the rest of the story, really.
So were these people who painted this cave art and made these objects, were they definitely of nature?
They were of their world. They were they painted the world of which they were an intimate part. They wouldn't have called it nature since they were so much a part of it that they didn't separate themselves from it.
Now, the rest of the book proceeds in an interesting way of tracing these different developments which seem to really change our relationship with the natural world. And the first one is the process of cultivation and domestication. Can you just talk about that?
Yeah, well, that seems to me a critical stage when we began to separate ourselves from nature. We domesticated it. We domesticated plants and grew crops. We domesticated animals and used them, and in some cases befriended them as well. But it was at that point that we really made this basic distinction between humans and other animals, which is a theme that runs through the whole book. Are we an animal, or are we something different from an animal? Or are we a rather special kind of animal, with therefore special kinds of responsibilities towards other animals, which is what I end up by concluding. So this was a crucial stage. We domesticated various animals, and I give the examples of the big five, the goats, the sheep, the pigs, the cattle, and the horses. And I also give the example of the cats and the dogs, which became domestic animals of a different kind. And what's common to all these cases, and quite interesting, I think, is that we took advantage of these creatures in obvious ways for our own material benefit. But they were also agents in this story, in a way, in that it suited their evolution
That's
to
right.
attach themselves to humankind, so that we were part of their evolutionary history, too. And you can present it, if you want to, as a human story or an animal story, since there were benefits on both sides to this new symbiotic relationship that we formed.
I think it's amazing, and you write this in your book, that 96% of all land animals today are domesticated.
Yeah.
What a different world from the Paleolithic artists.
Absolutely, absolutely. Turned it completely on its head.
Wow.
And in making that distinction between the domestic and the wild, there are other distinctions that emerge too, which I make in my book. The wild isn't a straightforward category either. There are some animals that have not encountered human beings that are quite tame while being wild, but they're not domesticated. And I give the famous example of Darwin, who went and hit one of these animals on the head to as a specimen. It was a kind of fox, wasn't it? later mounted it in a museum. But that animal was wild, but it was also tame in a sense. So there are further distinctions that you can make between these different cases.
Is it based entirely on how we use them, or their behavior, or both?
I think, in the case of the distinction I've just made, it's that some animals that have not encountered human beings before have no natural fear of them. That's the origin of that particular case.
It's interesting because I took a trip to Lord Howe Island off the coast of Australia.
Oh, yeah.
And they have a large flightless rail, the Lord Howe Island woodhen there. And the ones that survived after the introduction to rats were the ones that were way up on the tops of these two huge mountains. And they've brought them down. And because there's no hunting of them, they're fearless of humans. I mean, I sat down and one walked over to me and sort of pecked around on my shoes. And,
yeah.
And the thing is, it's not domesticated at all.
No.
It just hasn't experienced us, which gives me a chill to think about. That's what that behavior is about.
Yes. And, of course, that that distinction becomes quite important when you're thinking about the hypothesis that various people put forward, that there was a great overkill, that
human
beings were responsible for the extinction of the megafauna on the grounds that as human beings went into new territories like Australia, like
North America.
Yeah. They encountered animals that had never had any experience of human beings, and therefore they were easy prey. And there's a whole science, no, I wouldn't call it science, there's a whole, there's a story, if you like, a mythology, that human beings caused the extinction of the megafauna. That's rather doubted now, but it's an example of the sort of case you've just mentioned.
That, and that's a complicated phenomenon, or an idea, let me put it that way, to think about, because there's a lot of people who react against it because it reflects poorly on indigenous people. But
yeah,
there's a lot of evidence for the fact something like that happened. Now, also, climate change happened, and that that sort of has to have had something to do with it.
That's favored now as the major explanation, in fact. And, of course, there could be all kinds of other subsidiary explanations, like human beings destroying certain habitats,
yes,
which then impacted on the megafauna. Or even human beings introducing a kind of virus that might have impacted on the megafauna, which are not then ways of that don't involve human beings as the principal culprits in just killing them.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is writer and historian, natural historian, Jeremy Minot. He is an emeritus fellow of Wolfson College, Cambridge, and was formerly chief executive of Cambridge University Press, a position which I envy him no end. We are now, and we're talking about his new book. It's amazing. The Story of Nature, A Human History. Jeremy, this brings us to the next big evolution in changing our relationship to the natural world, and that's writing.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I think there's a Zen koan that says, as soon as you name something, you've lost it.
That's interesting, yeah. Though you could turn it around and say, as soon as you name it, you've found it.
But you've lost the certain connection that you had with it, and now you're looking at it through the writing.
Yes, that's true. But I think it's also true that there are certain things which are very hard to discuss, certainly hard to analyze, unless you put names to them and can connect them in a natural language.
But by doing that, by sorting things out, by developing taxonomy, we have definitely changed the way we think about nature.
You do. You put sharp divisions between blurred areas. That's quite true, yeah. But I do think that the invention of language, which I deal with in a chapter on the ancient world, was part of what enabled them to perform the extraordinary acts of speculation and analysis and discovery about the natural world, which was characteristic of early Greece and Rome. And I think the discoveries they made and the speculations, which were some of which were a bit weird, were quite extraordinary and probably wouldn't have been achieved unless it had been part of a civilization that had become semi-literate.
As you're right, Greeks invented the idea of nature, and there were the sort of pre-Socratic philosophers and writers, Anaximander, Thales, Xenophanes. Can you talk a little bit about how they thought about nature?
Yeah, I mean, I just love the pre-Socratics. I just love their courage and their boldness and the extraordinary freedom of the ideas they speculated on. They weren't really scientific ideas in the sense that we would use that word because they didn't test them experimentally. But take the case of Anaximander, who actually is of particular importance to me because he wrote a book, and his book was called On Nature, Periphusias in the Greek. And some of his ideas, I can summarize one or two of them for you. I've got a page in front of me, actually. He said, Anaximander says that the earth is held up on high, supported by nothing, but stays in its place because of its equal distance from everything else. Now, the physicist Carlo Rovelli, who's a famous best-selling physicist, said that this was one of the most beautiful moments in the history of scientific thinking, that someone should imagine that the earth need not be resting on something, but could be held up on high, as Anaximander puts it. And another one, which is a bit more closer to natural history, he speculates that the first living creatures were generated in moisture, and as they matured, they came out onto dry land, and when their shells broke off, they lived in a different form of life for a short time. I mean, that's just extraordinary.
It's like the proto-ideas of gravity, like evolution. I mean, it's amazing to me to read these pre-Socratics.
I think it's just amazing, and they were stimulated by curiosity and a sense of wonder, which is the theme, one of the other themes that runs through this book. And they weren't scientists, but I think the first person you could say was a scientist was probably Aristotle, who systematized all this stuff and made many empirical discoveries of his own. But I'm a great lover of the pre-Socratics just because they opened up all these questions.
I know, they were the first ones to do this, to be sort of philosophical, to figure out ideas. To me, it's incredible. I mean, who was the first Greek to think about atoms? Was it Democritus? I forget who it was.
Yes, that's right, Democritus. He was one of the sequence of pre-Socratics, and he hypothesized that the world just consisted in atoms, and the whole of the visible world can be explained by the movement of tiny atoms, which differed only in their kinds of combination, and that there were innumerable worlds composed of atoms like this. Another quite extraordinary speculation. What's so striking about the pre-Socratics is that it's the first humanistic rather than scientific speculation. Before the pre-Socratics, there were myths explaining these things, and the myths usually involve one of the gods like Zeus causing the lightning or intervening in the world in some dramatic way. The pre-Socratics did it without the gods, that's the point. They didn't invoke the gods. They tried to find naturalistic explanations of what's going on. Some of them were weird and wrong. I mean, Thales thought the world was composed of water, it became gaseous when it evaporated, and it solidified as ice so that everything could be water in some sense. And they came up with ideas like this, but they were all naturalistic ideas. That was their importance.
Aristotle, actually, in his History of the Animals, talks about the value of nature. What did he believe that the value of nature was?
He has a kind of manifesto about how one should study nature, and two aspects of that manifesto strike me as particularly important. One is that he thinks we should follow the facts, that our current facts are incomplete, and if we find new facts and they change our theories, then we should follow those new facts. And that seems to me a principle of great scientific importance. Mm. The other thing he says, which is quite interesting, is that scientists or people who study nature shouldn't bring their own values too much to bear on what they're studying. That is, they should study all kinds of animals, not just those that they find charismatic or lovely or wonderful. That if you find something that worms or
a flea,
something even something repulsive to human beings, it's just as much a part of nature, and it just as much deserves study. And in fact, he says, there is something to be wondered at in all of nature, which is a wonderful statement.
It's funny when I think about today, about how many people I know who don't want to even see a picture of a snake or a spider, and our house centipedes freak everybody out because they move unusually. And I try to essentially explain to them the same thing, you know, look at it in a different way. And it really is a wondrous thing. It's really an amazing thing. Theophrastus, and I never knew this until I read your book, believe that cultivated plants are as natural as wild ones.
Yes, that's a really interesting speculation, isn't it?
Yeah.
Theophrastus did for the plant world what Aristotle did for the animal world, really. And he's not as well known, but he was a successor to Aristotle in running the research programs in the university that they called the Lyceum. And he is really the father of botany, Just to pick up something you said before, though, you gave the example of snakes, which is a very good one, because if you jump forward to John Ray, the English scientist and taxonomist who was a predecessor of Linnaeus, but a very important figure in the development of science, he said he couldn't bear to study snakes. He just was repelled by them. And this was a... Aristotle had none of that squeamishness. He liked getting his hands dirty, and he said everything deserves equal attention, and I think that was a wonderful dictum.
I can't believe a natural historian would say, I can't study snakes.
Yeah.
I and I say that because I absolutely adore snakes, and have done that all my life, since I was a baby. One of my earliest childhood pictures is me as a toddler covered with brown earth snakes that my brothers put all over my body.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah, and so ever since then, I'm attracted to snakes. I think snakes are amazing. You even talk about where the idea of Mother Nature comes from in the beginning of the book.
Yes.
But you know what? We're all out of time, and people are going to have to wait till our next interview to learn about that. And we've only covered the first few chapters in this book, which is so rich and really fascinating. My guest tonight, returning, is writer and historian Jeremy Minot. He is an emeritus fellow of Wolfson College, Cambridge, and was former chief executive of Cambridge University Press. And we've been talking about his new book, which is, it should be a must read, The Story of Nature, A Human History. Jeremy, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Mark. It's a pleasure to talk to you again.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.